Tate Publishing and Enterprises, along with Tate Out Loud Audiobooks, presents Caution, The Choice is Yours, written by Brian Lindberg, narrated by Chuck Ither Agas. Introduction. Believe that life is worth living, and your belief will help create the fact. William James. The title says it all. I am over a half century old, and I am getting older by the second. I believe many facts make me, including the following. I live a thoughtful life because I wrote a book. As long as I live, I have a purpose. I was born just like you. I'm a son and a dad. Life plays all stories simultaneously. I am a married Caucasian male with three children. I am created by God. How we came to be is a vital belief, one that determines future action and demands more than casual consideration. In 2011, Ipsos conducted a poll for Reuters News in 24 countries. The issue was about the beliefs of the origins of human beings. Respondents were prompted with a statement, "There has been some debate recently. Please tell me which of the following is closer to your own point of view." They were presented with the following. Some people referred to as evolutionists believe that human beings evolved over a long period of time and grew into the fully formed human beings they are today from lower species such as apes. Some people referred to as creationists believe that human beings are created by a spiritual force such as a god. They do not believe that the origin of man came from an evolving species such as apes. Some people simply don't know what to believe, and sometimes agree or disagree with theories and ideas put forward by both creationists and evolutionists. The results indicated that 41% identify themselves as evolutionists, 28% as creationists, and 31% indicated that they simply don't know what to believe. The evolutionist view was most popular in Sweden, 68%, with the United States ranking 28th, 28%. The creationist view was most popular in Saudi Arabia, 75%, with the United States ranking 6th, 40%. No surprise that some believe in God, others don't, and some are unsure. The interesting thing is the three groups closely divide into thirds, meaning a third do believe in creation or evolution, and a third are not sure. Belief is a powerful thing. It's not easily separated from the believer. This is what concerns me, that a third of us do not seem to have a belief, unlike the 10th dentist in a popular toothpaste commercial. Remember those commercials that state, 9 out of 10 dentists recommend? That is a brave dentist. I mean, 9 of his colleagues chose brand XYZ. And he's stuck to his conviction and said no. I want to know more of the other 9. Did they all agree? If so, my admiration for number 10 grows. I bet at least 4 could not decide. The power is in the choice. In my experience, the choice depends upon 3 types of people. The do's, the don'ts, and the dazed. These 3 kinds of people or personalities decide the decisions. The do's solve problems on their own. There is no magic to their problem-solving skills other than the fact of focusing on the solution rather than the problem. The opposing person is the don'ts. These people are so obsessed with a problem to the point that they are blinded to any possible solution. Last are the dazed. They are neither do's nor don'ts, but they are rather confused. I am a Christian and a therapist. Therefore, I am a Christian therapist, and my belief in God influences my thoughts. Belief is a strong thing, if it is more than a casual acquaintance. It is not my intention to separate anyone from their belief. I only offer my experience as a Christian and a therapist. I am a therapist, not a counselor, because your view of the problem is seldom what I see. My solutions are not what you think they are. They are what I think the problem is. Sometimes you're right and I am wrong, and sometimes it is the other way around. But after nearly 2 decades of experience, I am seldom wrong. Offering solutions is a nice way of saying manipulation. People think manipulation is bad, but we live a life of manipulation. Each day, our emotion is skillfully handled or controlled to affect the life we live. Manipulation is a fact. It is also a tool. Like any tool, it can be either good or bad, depending on its use. Counselors and therapists are manipulators, hopefully for good. Ironically, for a therapist, the power of manipulation lays with the manipulated and not the manipulator. See? I do not choose. I simply supply the information. Of the hundreds of people I've met in nearly 20 years of therapy, they prove to be either one of those three types. The stories they tell are typically associated with who they are and seldom have anything to do with what they are. I say these things because the following 100 pages or so is my attempt at manipulation. And the effect of this manipulation is dependent upon you, the reader. I will tell you what I believe because I chose to believe it, just as you chose your beliefs. Considering a different way to look at a belief does not change it. I say this because many are threatened by considering a different perspective. This should not be the case, as it suggests a weakness in the belief. As a Christian therapist, I see God as the master therapist listening to our problems. He knows the problem better than we do. He will guide us for good, but that choice is ours. Listen to wisdom and do your best to understand. Ask for good judgment. Cry out for understanding. Look for wisdom like silver. Search for it like hidden treasure. If you do this, you will understand what it means to respect the Lord, and you will come to know God. Proverbs chapter 2, verses 2 to 5.
1. You gotta start somewhere. In the beginning. Everything is determined, the beginning as well as the end, by forces over which we have no control. It is determined for the insect, as well as for the star, human beings, vegetables, or cosmic dust. We all dance to a mysterious tune, intoned in the distance by an invisible piper. Albert Einstein. My story starts in the dark. Like most stories, the dark escapes as the light emerges. It is the first day from which all others will follow. Things unknown begin to focus as the story progresses. This is the first operation. Every action brings a consequence with it, and the story unfolds. So is the story of life, the story of creation. I believe it was a Saturday in the Garden of Eden. You can find the garden today in the Middle Eastern area known as the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley, the Fertile Crescent. On that day, God created the animals to fill the earth along with man and woman. The Maker created a couple in His image so they can commune together. The last part is worthy of attention. To commune with is a clue to the story. That's commune, as in bond, click, relate, and hit it off. The point I am subtly making is that, from the beginning, you and I were made in His image to bond. This is noteworthy because it reveals the plan, which is to bond. It is not a plan of casual acquaintance. The opening scene of the biblical drama introduces the two central characters in the Bible, God and us. I know Adam and Eve are frolicking in the garden eating fruit and feeding animals, but this is not the story. The real story is about you and me. From the beginning, it was a love story connecting us to the Creator. Mention the biblical creation story, and almost everyone thinks of the 6 days of creation and the day of rest. It then skips to the fall. I am referring not to the season, but to Eve's temptation by the serpent, leading to Adam and Eve's disobedience. This disobedience was the first sin, the original sin. A good drama reveals clues about the theme. Between the days of creation and the fruit of temptation lies a story of connection. The male and female of every animal, including Adam and Eve, are created revealing the importance of relationships in the divine plan. The plan hinges not on survival, but on perpetuation of the family. Tension always draws focus. It pumps adrenaline to a situation needing attention. Why is there trouble in paradise? Could it be that there is another story that affects the larger story? This tension comes in the form of two trees, the tree of life and the tree of knowledge. In the middle of the garden, He puts the tree of life and the tree that gives knowledge about good and evil,
Genesis chapter 2, verse 9. The stage is set. The drama begins. In the Fertile Crescent that provides a bounty of fruit, vegetables, and animals, there is one tree of which no one can eat the fruit. Of course, it wouldn't be paradise without temptation. See, temptation makes tension, the kind that demands your attention. The potency of temptation depends on the view. The knowledge of what you've got is only magnified when it is in jeopardy. Ignorance of it leads to its discarding. Only after it's gone do you realize what you had. The action that follows determines the story to be told. You may eat from any tree in the garden, but you must not eat from the tree that gives knowledge about good and evil. If you eat fruit from that tree, on that day you will certainly die. Genesis chapter 2, verses 16 to 17. It is a harsh verse. Eat this forbidden fruit and die. The warning of forbidden fruit is something I am familiar with, but no one has ever threatened me with death. While growing up in America's Bible Belt, I knew that there are all varieties of forbidden fruit. They're not lethal, but they do bring trouble to paradise. The Bible tells me that God never gives me more temptation than I can handle. No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and He will not let you be tempted beyond your ability. But with the temptation, He will also provide the way of escape, that you may be able to endure it. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13. He provided an escape from temptation. Mothers, they're forbidden fruit expert, and obviously, their mission is to point out that they know. As a teenage boy, it kind of freaked me out each time Mom helped identify forbidden fruit. As former teenagers, we don't need help identifying the fruit, only in escaping the temptation. Fruit experts will do best focusing on the virtues of the fruit. The tempting fruit may seem less tempting. See this apple? Stay away. There's a nice banana to hang out with. Yeah, that doesn't work. Point out the benefits of the banana and maybe the apple becomes less appealing. Bringing attention to something off limits turns attention to attraction. Except when it comes to bananas. I am happy to declare my independence from adolescent behavior. But temptation never leaves you. The secret is to use the tools in the shed, as in the brain. Start with a tool of reasoning, intellect, and then make the best choice. Getting it wrong the first time is not a big deal. Trial and error is part of building wisdom. It only took me 50 years. The tempter. The snake was the cleverest of all the wild animals that the Lord God had made. The snake spoke to the woman and said, "Woman, did God really tell you that you must not eat from any tree in the garden?" Genesis chapter 3, verse 1. In the Garden of Eden, the forbidden fruit brings tension to the story and draws attention to the hazards of the temptation. Without the tension caused by the forbidden fruit, the story of Adam and Eve would have a different ending. For one story to continue, another must end. So it is with our story of creation. The creation story ends to make way for a new story. It is our story, one that reveals the purpose of the relationship between the Creator and all of creation. To have any teeth, temptation wants two things, idea and action. The idea is the thought of flirting with temptation. Bring action to the idea, and danger is on the doorstep. The danger depends on what the brain comes up with. If it rapidly calculates the pros and cons with the odds of successful indulgence, you are gliding on lean, solidified hydrogen and oxygen. Safety is at hand, however, if the gray matter quickly sounds the alarm to advance with caution or to stop. This is that little voice that yells, "Hey, stupid!" The brain does this, whether you know it or not. Ever recognize that gut feeling? Yep, that's it. That dangerous idea triggers the absurd alarm inside your gut, giving you a split second to decide what comes next. Here's a fact. The enteric nervous system, gut, is one of the main parts of the nervous system. The more attention you pay to a virtue, good fruit, the faster the alarm sounds when you are in presence of a vice, bad fruit. But then here is earth-shattering news. The more you engage in certain actions, the more your brain sees it as normal behavior and accepts the result, no matter how absurd. The danger is when a recurring thought rents space in your head. The word for this is rumination. It is a thought that refuses to go away. It's the one that points out stuff that's not working or stuff that's not on the diet. The thing about bad thoughts is that they get more attention than the good ones. Actually, research says they get 5 times the attention. That's bad. Staying away from XYZ works for a little while, but soon XYZ is knocking on your old cerebral cortex. Once the door is open, it crashes on the couch. Come on. It's not XYZ. If it was, you would move away. Why haven't you moved? I think the answer is that flirting with temptation must be fun. Your lips say no, but your actions say yes. My patients are smart enough to know the correct answer to give, even if it is not true. I bet that when someone calls them out on their habit of flirting with temptation, they are clever enough to give some lame reason. Most people are aware of forbidden fruit and know the answer to give when called on it. That is what we in the profession call a lie or a denial. The good thing about temptation is the tension it makes. Pay attention. It may offer a solution. Problems occur when desire gets more attention than what's needed. Until the tempter, you, settle. Temptation is around each corner. It may even be sleeping on the couch. My first taste of counseling was in detox. I was the counselor, not the patient. My boss told me that the key to drug counseling was to identify and list the triggers that tempt patients. I remember thinking drug users are surely aware of triggers. Certainly, addiction is more complicated than simply pointing out triggers that cause cravings. I thought she was joking. I sarcastically answered, "Sure." It turns out that she was serious. The patients could not only spot the triggers, they could list them alphabetically and recite them in reverse if asked. A cocaine patient's trigger was crisp dollar bills, not those wrinkly ones vending machines refuse to eat. For a heroin addict, it was cotton balls, and silver aluminum cans triggered another. You can try avoiding dollar bills, cotton balls, and aluminum cans. The trouble is, you can't avoid yourself. In recovery, they say, an addict alone in a room is in bad company. The more you try to avoid temptation, the stronger the desire is to gain access to the source. This is because it is impossible to avoid yourself. Casino owners and psychologists know this. It's called stimulus reinforcement. It is the idea that reinforcement is an outcome that rewards you and therefore increases the odds of future behavior. A stronger effect means greater behavior, pulling a lever more often, and longer duration, pulling a lever for longer periods of time. Think of the one-armed bandit, a slot machine. The stimulus is the money, and the reinforcement is the winning. As long as you hear that metal clink in the stainless steel tray, you keep pulling the lever. The machine is programmed to pay out just enough to keep you playing. It's called intermittent reinforcement. You cannot walk away because the reward is just a few pulls away. It is a conditioning response meant to reward you just enough to keep you hooked. This is the basis to all temptation. There is a stimulus. Let's call this an idea. The more thought given to an idea, the greater the likelihood of action. Adding action to the idea makes it real. The reinforcement, consequence, will depend on pleasure or pain, either good or bad, and that will determine if you keep flirting with temptation. Exposure therapy is a way to neutralize the reinforcement. Once the light bulb comes on, realize that the problem is the one with the idea. Recognize the thought that triggers the desire. You can go to the fanciest therapist you can find. Guess what they'll do? They will help you recognize the moment that crazy idea shows up. A thought is controllable because you are the thinker, and by doing so, you can settle the tempter. The thought can focus on virtue or vice. The choice is yours. In our creation story, the fruit is the temptation in disguise, like the poisoned apple in the story of Snow White. The commandment not to eat the fruit is the tension. Anxiety arises with a realization of personal responsibility, as in, I am supposed to be somewhere else or do something else requiring personal responsibility. The adrenaline starts pumping. It is an unpleasant state of inner turmoil.
often accompanied by nervous behavior. And so it is with a command. The tension reminds us of what is expected. The desire for obtaining the object is not the stimulus. The stimulus is the thought of the reward. If you cannot consider your action very carefully, half of the time, that reward would turn into punishment. The serpent is the master of doubt. He is an evil manipulator, portrayed as a trickster who promotes as good what God has forbidden. Displaying particular cunning in its deception, the serpent tells Eve the hidden reward for her disobedience. The seed planted is doubt. This is the moment faith is questioned. Do I know what I believe? And do I believe what I know? The snake said to the woman, "You will not die. God knows that if you eat the fruit from the tree, you will learn about good and evil, and then you will be like God." Genesis chapter 3, verse 4 to 5. Doubt. Doubt isn't the opposite of faith. It is an element of faith. Paul Tillich. Doubt lies somewhere between belief and disbelief. It involves uncertainty, distrust, and the lack of sureness in what you know, do, feel, or decide. Doubt questions what you believe as well as your thoughts, feelings, and decisions. It is the rascal responsible for delaying or rejecting a decision based on the fear of mistake. Doubt crippled my dancing. I was 17 before I slow danced. A decision based on the fear of mistake or embarrassment prevented me from approaching a girl. It was a decision based on doubt. That decision resulted from focusing on everything that could go wrong. In other words, giving more thought to the bad instead of good is bad. A decision involves weighing the options equally than choosing. Doubt that permeates fear is bad doubt. It essentially hijacks the thinking process until the thought of failure takes a seat on the couch. The longer that thought stays, the harder it is to move. At this point, you even doubt the people trying to help. This is bad because you moved from neutral to reverse. To move back to neutral, shut up, sit down, and start doing the opposite. Temptation is not dangerous until the flirting begins. It is the prelude to action. Only execution takes flirtation to the danger zone. Flirting with temptation is not advisable, unless you're prepared to lose. Between feeling and action, there is a decision to act or not. Do I dance or not? This is an intersection worth visiting. It is worth visiting because all the tools are designed to pass through this intersection. Doubt is agathocacological, both good and bad. Weighing a list of pros and cons is good. A tool, like doubt, is only as good as the user. Decision-making is a complex brain process known as thinking. People do this before speaking. There are times when thinking occurs after speaking. Typically, this is not advised. Thinking is responsible for choosing a belief or an action, just like talking before thinking. Believing or doing something you don't understand is not good. Do enough thinking, and soon your brain has a flowchart to follow. The flowchart is a record of action. Have I done this before? If yes, proceed to step C. If no, proceed to step B. Every choice ends with a decision, and that decision controls the action. That choice is stored in the amygdala region of the brain for future use. The amygdala is an almond-shaped set of neurons found deep in the medial temporal lobe and plays a key role in processing emotions. The problem is not that you don't have a flowchart, because you do. The problem is you're not using it. Ignoring a warning alarm can be painful. When that ignored warning is from the brain, it is unofficially called stinkin' thinkin'. It is the habit of making bad decisions, as in, that idea stinks. This is a case of zigging when the action called for a zag, of saying yes when the answer is no. There are two reasons for consistently zigging instead of zagging, for choosing false rather than true. It's either you have a faulty flowchart or you are not using it properly. Every action follows thought. Everyone prefers pleasure to pain. So the best way to preserve the flowchart is to focus on the pain that causes change. It is counterintuitive to focus on pain over pleasure. And that is exactly why it works. Focusing on pain is not dwelling, it's learning. Tori, my wife, and I are stress weenies. So much so that we focus on it.
This focus helps us to see it on the horizon. On the horizon, it says, and the result is increased pleasure. Only a radical motivation like you have a month to live unless will change thinking. The first step is to strip the doubt to neutral. That is, you should erase past mistakes and stop obsessing about yesterday or tomorrow. There is a story of a man who could not do this. He regretted his decisions of the past day and worried about his choices of the next. It was a state of doubt locking the man in a state of indecision. Thus, he consistently stood with one foot in tomorrow and the other in yesterday. The result? He urinated on today. A good start is finding a stranger or a distant acquaintance that can offer a clear, unbiased opinion, as in, they'll give it to you straight. A pastor, priest, rabbi, or bartender will do. Keep looking until someone says something you don't like. The first person you disagree with is the person worth listening to. It's a less case where you don't want to be told that you don't know what you think you know. No one is a good judge of themselves, which is why they like judging others. There it is, right in the middle of thought and action is the tempter. The highest likelihood of success or failure depends on actions based on the amount of thought put into them. Brilliant success is based on action. The odds of achievement depend on how much thinking occurs before the action. It is no more complicated than that. Homework. Watch The Truman Show with the idea that life is a stage. Everything is perceived, meaning reality is what you make. After watching the movie, answer the following questions. What does it mean to define a problem? Does that change the problem? Is life fixed or is it manipulated? What are the implications of either? List three examples of good manipulation. List three examples of bad manipulation. What role does doubt play in both? Recall the last event you experienced either. What was the date? What was the outcome? What did you learn personally? How will this affect future decisions? This is how you start a flowchart. 2. The assumption is you care. Do you care? Caring about people, about things, about life is an act of maturity. Tracy McMillan. The assumption is you care. There is the danger of assuming, but if you don't care, it doesn't matter. There are those that say they don't care, and they actually don't. These people know what they believe, and they believe they know more than you. The problem is, they don't care what anyone else knows. I like these people because I don't waste my time. No extra effort is expended to convince them to care. Life eventually does that. Then there are those that say they don't care but do. I like these people because they're entertaining. They convince themselves that they don't really care. They convince themselves that they don't care by trying to convince others they don't. But here's a hint. Energy that is spent convincing others that you don't care shows that you care. The third and last is one who says they do care, but don't. Stay wary of them. They have an agenda that is just for them. They are pretending to care only lasts until you realize they don't. This severe form of egotism is called narcissism. There is bad and worse news. The bad news is, the don't will give 50% to your 100. It doesn't matter if it's work, church, or Girl Scouts. They are happy to volunteer to have you to do the work. Afterward, it's realized that their enjoyment is at others' expense. That is where the Bible refers to as unequally yoked, as in one of the oxen is pulling the weight for the ass. Do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers. For what partnership has righteousness with lawlessness? Or what fellowship has light with darkness? 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 14. The worst news is when the don't give a 100% to your 100 until they have 200% and you are broken. I know a man who after 60 years of stinking thinking and selfish action said he cared but didn't. He said he was ready to change but wasn't. He said he learned but was still ignorant. His choices were self-indulgent and hedonistic. As he relayed his sad story, he seemed sincere. Despite financial wealth, He was morally bankrupt and alone. Life has a way of catching you in the end. There is always a day of reckoning. He foolishly made his money at the expense of others, and for some reason, he did not think the law of time applied to him. At age 78, he was surrounded by multiple versions of himself trying to take his money. He had no peace, and he created his hell. My job was to write a different ending to this story he wrote. Like most people, he refused to accept responsibility for living the story he made. Step one of rewriting a bad story is the painstaking review of the errors, of his many choices to separate himself from his wife, family, and friends. The same wife, family, and friends that would have given him the ending he now seeks. Kudos goes to him for putting forth the effort to change, even if he didn't persevere. The relief from pain brings people to my door, but the effort to rewrite the ending of a 78-year-old story is huge. And the pain needed for healing is even more. The longer the wait is to correct bad choices, the greater the pain that results. There is the story of two ER nurses. A mom brings her little boy to the hospital with a wound. The first nurse dabbed the injury gently, being careful not to cause additional pain. The second nurse pulls out one of those iodine scrub brushes and proceeds to scour the wound. The first nurse had good intent by not inflicting pain. However, the result is a wound partially cleaned, which results in a longer recovery. The second nurse, also with good intent, inflicted pain in the process of thoroughly cleaning the wound. The result is a faster, fuller recovery. The point of the story is clear. No pain, no gain. After 2 months of wound cleaning, the flowchart was corrected. The thinking appeared to be working. Typically, this is a point of spontaneous correction to stinkin' thinking. There was none. This was the first clue of a don't in disguise. The tools worked, but there was no effort to use them. The decision-making machine got a nudge by introducing ideas like integrity, honor, and needed repair to burnt bridges. He hesitated by using delay tactics. This would be the second clue. The confirmation occurred a month later with a confession of another woman. He assured it was his first real true love. My only response was reconciliation. A reminder of integrity, honor, and priorities discussed for the past months, as well as the effort needed to correct past mistakes. The reply was a nod of the head in agreement, but an I can't. Dude, not even an I'll try. I later learned that therapists don't fire their patients. A quick note about reconciliation. It's about peace. To reconcile means reaching an agreement or harmonious decision. I meet couples who either do not understand or don't care to reunite with each other. Divorced couples destroy their kids by not caring about the other parent. Newsflash, that other is your child's parent. This is one of those times when people know the right words to say but do the opposite. The thing about not caring is that your children learn not to care from you. I care because the day of reckoning is coming, and it won't be pretty. Courts refer divorced couples to me because the stinking thinking reaches near comical levels. Divorced couples told to reconcile have a look of astonishment as they sarcastically explain that they're divorced because they could not reconcile. After thanking them for the clarification, I explain that their failure to settle resulted in the marital crash. Here's the problem. Your kids are still on that train. Until you make up and work in harmony, you're going to blow it up. People always get themselves in train wrecks. I say themselves because they are driving the train. In 12 years of practice, I have yet to hear of a true train robbery. No one jumped on board, gagged, tied, and held them at gunpoint. It's easier to explain a hijacking than it is to accept responsibility for the crash. If you weren't driving and let someone else crash, guess what? You're still responsible. I had my share of crashes and spent time convincing others and myself that I was hijacked. It wasn't until I took responsibility for the crashes that they stopped. Doubt is a prelude to seduction, which is the dark side. Think about it. Each time the dark side seduces you, there is a moment of hesitation. In that moment of doubt and distrust, while you are staring at the headlights of the oncoming train, doubt whispers a forewarning of danger ahead. Remember, doubt is agathocalcological, both good and bad. It is a tool like the others in the shed. It will depend on what you choose. An example of doubt that is used for good happens on The Truman Show. It records the life of a man who is at first unaware that he is living in a modeled reality television show. Truman becomes suspicious of his perceived reality and embarks on a search to discover the truth about his life. This was a Shakespeare moment. Life is but a stage. Since that day, there is no need to retell It's a Wonderful Life, because it is more important to know how you know it's not a wonderful life. What is life? Do you and I share the same life? If there is doubt, then how do I know that you know what you're talking about? The Fall. If you could not accept the past and its burden, there was no future, for without one, there cannot be the other. Robert Penn Warren, All the King's Men. There comes a point in every story where it gets exciting. Is there any point in adult story? In the creation story, the fall is when the things get interesting theologically. If you look for the clues, the story begins to unfold. In literature, this is called the inciting event. It is the point where it gets exciting, because the story goes somewhere and shows you the deeper message. Inciting events are exciting. You get that. One event influences the internal drama that changes the external drama. It tilts the story from order to chaos, from predictability to confusion. In our creation story, orderly creation in a beautiful garden is disrupted, leaving the future uncertain. You're hooked and will stay with it until the end. At this moment, something major has happened to change the story, and you discover that you don't know what you thought you knew. It is a time when the beginning of the story is not going to be the ending. I think this is why Tori needs the ending first. She wants to know what she doesn't know before she knows it. You know, boring. What's the use of reading the story if you know the ending? The surprise of the drama is discovered when you don't know what you thought you knew. This is why I loved being read to as a child. I carefully follow each action in anticipation of the consequence and what the character will do. The beginning is the introduction, and the ending is the conclusion to life. Pay attention, and don't be in a rush because all the inciting stuff happens in the middle. All inciting events of life are opportunities for change. Some are good, while some are bad. How sad to come to the end of life and not know the story the author laid out from the beginning, or to realize that you missed opportunities because of your selfish agenda. The regret people share with me is not of the choice made as much as the regret of not choosing. In fiction, you look forward to the inciting incident. In non-fiction, not so much. Finding the trigger to the smoking gun is the key to the inciting event. In psychology, it's called pathology. It is part of what I do. Typically, I hear decent stories that have turned bad. In therapy, the story starts backwards to the inciting scene. Once found, the rewriting begins to get an acceptable ending. Sometimes it's not the ending you expect or want. It all depends on how awful the story became and how long it stays bad. The longer you are in a bad story, the less likely it is that the ending will be as good as you expect. It is no surprise, then, that life is a story that unfolds with each decision. Each event is an outline, flowchart of your life that reveals more clues, if you pay attention. What surprises me are the numbers of careless writers haphazardly thumbing through the pages of life. They passively jot down a testimony of facts that are without meaning, as if they were writing an almanac instead of a story. This passive writing is how you create an awful ending to a meaningless story. If life has no meaning, the story has no meaning. It's unavoidable. Overlook the inciting events, and you overlook opportunity. It is the opportunity to accept the importance of the story and the responsibility to change it. The Chinese have a word for the time to change. That word is weiji. It is made up of two symbols that, when combined, translate into precarious opportunity. Those of you who speak Mandarin and dispute my translation, I say, dui bu gi. The real travesty is that if they are unheeded, all the clues needed to learn the purpose of your story get missed. View the fall through the lens of the inciting incident or weiji and see another story, one that reveals the purpose of all relationships and life. God placed Adam and Eve in the garden to commune with him. Feeding the animals was a side job. He warned them not to eat the fruit from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. The knowledge of good and evil comes with a responsibility for the use of that understanding. It would forever change the story. When the serpent gets Eve's attention, she tells the serpent what God said. The serpent replies by chanting a seed of doubt and thus puts her in a precarious opportunity. The snake said to the woman, "You will not die. God knows that if you eat the fruit from that tree, you will learn about good and evil, and then you will be like God." Genesis chapter 3, verse 4-5. The serpent tells Eve, "That's silly. You won't die. It's just the opposite. You will be alive. Instead of childlike innocence, you will be like God, knowing good and evil." It's not the unneeded attention to the fruit, but a seed of doubt that has done the damage. An idea is a powerful thing. The idea is in the form of another, deceptive interpretation to challenge what she thinks. It takes root and bears doubt. Sin occurs when focus is paid to the vice, covet, rather than the virtue, content. It was the desire to have more that led Eve astray. So they ate the fruit, but the knowledge they gained was that of the dark side. With the knowledge of evil, they lost their childlike innocence and became aware of the deception. In their banishment from the garden, they became responsible for their actions. This is the original sin, and ironically, the beginning of our story. The clue is the promise of a new beginning. After disobedience, there is punishment. This is how it is in our home, and I imagine it is the same in yours. After punishment comes reconciliation. This is how it is in ours, as I imagine it is in yours. To the woman he said, "I will make your pains in childbearing very severe. With painful labor, you will give birth to children." To Adam he said, "Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil, you will eat food from it all the days of your life." Genesis chapter 3, verses 16-17. The fall into sin changes the environment, so everywhere, good and evil intertwine, the one growing out of the other. Where there is pain, there is strength that moves the story to a future of gain. This perspective alone produces great misfortune, irony, and drama in the human story. This is a necessary part of the story. Without it, Adam and Eve never leave the garden, and the story of us doesn't happen. It is the story of free will and faith that conquers evil to produce blessing, praise, and strength. Evil is present so that you and I may become greater than ourselves. Eve taking a bite is not the drama. It is the inciting event, and that is exciting. The event influenced the internal drama and propelled the external drama. The fall is the purpose of the creation story. The inciting event changes the happy couple. It represents the first action from which everything else follows. This is the beginning of the family. Even with a drama, there is a larger story to be told. The larger story is of atonement, the story of God's relationship with you and me. From the beginning, it is about your relationship with God. This is my story. It is a story of endless potential, all waiting for an idea, a belief. The choice is yours. Homework. List the things in your life that are both good and bad, agathocacological, depending on how you use it. How many things do you do daily that are based more on feeling than on thought? Relationships are a combination of thought and feeling. Are your relationships based more on feeling or thought? Is that good or bad? Why? The capacity to care is based on a combination of thought and feeling. Is your caring based more on objective thought or subjective feeling? Is that good or bad? Why do you think people let their feelings prevent them from caring about others? Do you think this is the same reason people judge one another and refuse to forgive? Why?